he thought was excessive, so he suggested that they stop, and lo and behold, the coughs went away.
More than 500 patients at five different clinics around Wisconsin were surveyed for the study, which was published in the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine. Shimei Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD sports and weather. NBA, Bucks and Bulls both off last night. Tonight, the Bucks host the Knicks. The Bulls play the Pistons in Detroit. NHL, Blackhawks lost to the Carolina Hurricanes 3-2 last night. They're off tonight. The forecast from the National Weather Service. Today, cloudy in the morning, sunny in the afternoon, a high of 36. Tonight, clear and cold, a low of 17. For the weekend, keep in mind, daylight saving time starts this weekend. Set your clock ahead 1 hour Saturday night before you go to bed. And the weekend, weather-wise, sunny, temperatures in the upper 30s both days. So here are the current numbers just in. Wind from the west at 8. Pretty good cloud cover. 26 degrees Racine, 25 Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD and The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, in partnership with UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu. It's exactly 12 minutes after 8 o'clock, and we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm extremely excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show because I am extremely excited to talk about this wonderful book that is before me, a book called One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and A Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. The town in question is Lewiston, Maine, Maine's second largest city, and a city in what is perhaps the whitest state in the country. And Lewiston itself was fairly white for a while, and then that changed quite dramatically beginning in 2001 with a influx of refugees from Africa, especially from Somalia. And in what I'm sure to the residents of Lewiston felt like an instant, the demographic landscape of Lewiston was drastically altered. And as you can well imagine, such a drastic change was not without its pain, was not without its controversy. Out of that, though, has emerged a very much inspiring and radiant story, and nothing has, in a sense, encapsulated that or embodied that as much as the story of the soccer team at the high school in Lewiston, which rose to great prominence and fame, and not in small measure due to some of these very, very talented and courageous young athletes from Africa who became a very important part of the team, and I'm sure to this day continue to be. Amy Bass has written this fascinating book about this important story. She is actually a history professor at the College of New Rochelle, and also on her shelf at home is an Emmy Award for the work which she did at some point with NBC. This book, published by Hachette, is again called One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. Amy Bass, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Tell us how you found out about this story unfolding in Lewiston, Maine, and at what point did it become clear to you that you were going to have to write a book about this?
So I am a proud graduate of Bates College, which is in Lewiston, Maine. So before the story of the Somalis in Lewiston started, I lived there for 4 years as an undergraduate. And so it's always, you know, the city has stayed on my radar because of that. But in the fall of 2015, a friend posted a small newspaper article about the team on her Facebook page, of all places. And it really caught my eye. I've spent a long time writing about, you know, sort of politics and sports and the meaning of sports. So this story really had a hook for me about this incredible soccer team that was breaking records and making history in Maine. And I wrote a couple hundred words for CNN, and the piece went pretty viral. And within about 48 hours, an editor had reached out to me and said, "Have you thought about writing a book?" And my answer was, I've pretty much thought about nothing else. Mm. And off we went.
When did that odyssey for you, in a sense, begin? That is, at what point did you begin work on what ultimately became this book, One Goal?
Yeah, it began right then. You know, I was in conversation with the varsity soccer coach, Coach Mike McGraw, who is certainly a central character in the book, and also with another one of the community leaders, Abdi Kadir Negi, who is one of the founders of what is now called Maine Immigrant and Refugee Services, and one of their big components is youth soccer, amongst many other things that support the community. So right from the get-go, sort of hitting pinpoints with these two guys, we were off and running.
I have interviewed actually several different authors who have written books at least roughly comparable to this, but never anyone who's written it exactly this story. And this story, of course, has its own particular unique dimensions, although what has played out in Lewiston to varying degrees and in different ways is, of course, played out in all kinds of different places. Tell us about how you went about learning more about this story, even as the story was unfolding, and the ways in which you went about trying to understand Lewiston, Maine better and its complicated population.
Yeah, so there were a lot of different modes of research. I spent a lot of time in Lewiston, Maine. I can tell you that, you know, thinking about the mileage on my car is something that makes me shudder even still. So sort of embedding myself in the city, hanging out so that I'm there. But there's multiple components. I mean, this is a soccer story. So, you know, getting every shred of game footage and newspaper clippings and play-by-plays and being able to talk to the coaches and the players in depth about their wonderful soccer skills, their superlative soccer season, was a huge component of this. But then there's the line of humanity that this story is very much a part of. So talking to families and sisters and brothers and teachers and coaches and broader members of the community was also really critical. And then, you know, wrapping my head around some more traditional kinds of research about the city and its history, spending a lot of time, someone like the deputy city administrator, you know, being in City Hall and talking about the different machinations of this story from that perspective, from a civic perspective, spending time with people like, you know, the high school principal or some teachers. So it came from all sides to make this, you know, a very sort of double thread narrative. It's very much, I think, a thrilling, adrenaline-charged soccer story. And I also think that there's a lot to learn from the different journeys in this book in terms of the people who are playing that game.
Right. I appreciate that in so many respects, this is ultimately, as you said, a thrilling soccer story. And without giving too much away, I mean, ultimately a very much a, let's say, a feel-good story. I mean, it just sort of makes you feel good about the world and maybe hopeful for the future and so on. And yet there are certainly darker aspects to this story, and you certainly do not shy away from them. One of the things that impresses me about the book is that I think you at least attempt to try to be fair to all sides in terms of being fair to those who were not maybe immediately enthusiastic or quite so welcoming, and perhaps some who were even openly hostile to these newcomers to the community. Can you just say a word about that challenge in what you were doing in terms of telling all sides of this story, even if there was, in a sense, one side of the story about which you felt a special affinity and affection.
Yes, well, I root unabashedly for the Blue Devils, so that little piece of bias should be out there. I'm on the sidelines yelling for this team as loud as anybody. The dark sides of this, the painful, I think, moments of this story are really important to it, because we want to talk about it as a story of overcoming, I think, and that's where you sort of get that feel-good, heartwarming sense and sensibility that you're talking about. But you need to know what's being overcome and what kinds of challenges and hurdles are in place. And you also, you don't want to be too Pollyannish about this stuff, or else it's not going to mean anything. So I think for the story to have meaning, I needed to dive deeply into the stereotypes about Somali immigrants that swirled, and to a degree still swirl, around in Lewiston, about the issues of poverty that Lewiston has always dealt with, before this immigrant influx. And to deal with the kinds of stuff that these players hear on the field, and what kind of, it's a particular kind of trash talk that a player from Lewiston experiences, and putting that into a broader context of where this stuff comes from. I think that one of my driving forces through this, particularly looking at the national rhetoric about immigrants and refugees in the United States right now, was to think there's a lot of fear out there. There's a lot of fear of the unknown, and that's very deeply embedded and tied to the hatred. So how do we put this fear in a context? What kind of context can we put it into to understand it and get at it and think about what it is to overcome it?
It's one of the best reasons for this story to be told as thoroughly as you tell it. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Amy Bass, and we're talking about her new book called One Goal: A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. The town in question is Lewiston, Maine. We're going to be talking a little bit more about Lewiston, and then we will talk about the drastic situation of hardship and peril that has driven so many refugees out of Africa and into what they hope will be safe and welcoming harbors, like Lewiston, Maine, to build new lives for themselves. Let's talk first about Lewiston, Maine itself. We've already identified it as Maine's second largest city, a place that you knew earlier in your life as an undergrad college student. You say early in the book, Lewiston isn't the Maine of blueberry pie and lobster bell sailboats and the Bush family. It is another side of Maine that we see, particularly at the outset of this story. Set this in context for us, the kind of city that Lewiston was, particularly in 2001, at the time that some of these African refugees first began making their way to Lewiston. Describe what the landscape there was like, particularly economically.
Yeah, well, economically, it was trying to stabilize and recover, and it had a lot of strategies in place to do that. Lewiston, historically, is a classic New England mill town. It was a textile center. Its nickname was Spindle City, because in the 19th century, a bunch of entrepreneurs from Boston, went north and found water power on the Androscoggin River. And so Lewiston, is a city of red brick factory buildings and canals that siphoning off the river, and thrived as this industrial powerhouse. Its workforce came largely from the north. So French Canadians populated those mill jobs and settled. And that's what really created the tone of Lewiston and set the tone of Lewiston. French speaking in many quarters, and overwhelmingly Catholic and overwhelmingly white. But the textile industry, the bottom falls out for New England. But Lewiston, unlike some of its other cities in New England, Lewiston doesn't crumble completely. And in 2001, when the first Somali refugees knock on its door, you see, some ideas and some things in place of how to reutilize the factory space. And the city is creating strategies to do that, and then the Somalis show up, and one of the things that does is it creates a workforce, again, another shot in the arm for this city. So there's a lot of things in play. But you know, Lewiston has some of the poorest neighborhoods in Maine. It has dealt with white intergenerational poverty for decades. And it was it's a complicated economic and demographic situation.
Hmm. We want to talk about, at least a little bit, the desperation of many of these African refugees who have found their way to various places in both Europe and North America, including Lewiston, Maine. And you don't spend a whole lot of time, but enough time in your book describing some of what these people have experienced, the kind of terrible situations and dangerous situations that, in a sense, gave them no other reasonable choice but to leave and try to find a new home someplace else. Tell our listeners what I am referring to here and what kinds of things maybe were revelatory to you personally as you delved into this tragic reality a little deeper than you perhaps had ever before.
Yeah, well, you know, refugees are an ongoing global issue. I don't want to call them a problem because, you know, there's 60 million refugees in the world right now. They're a nation. There's a nation out there of refugees. And looking at the crisis in Syria, which is just ongoing and ongoing, you get a taste of what is pushing people out of where they live. So Somalia had a lot of things to create, you know, what's called a failed state. It had political upheavals. It had that were added to by drought and then famine, just catastrophic drought and famine. So when you bring together drought and famine and political instability, and then the rise of armed military factions and what have you, it was what is considered to be a failed state. Looking at the late 80s, going into the 1990s, so there's this enormous exodus. And it is desperation. It is trying to get as many members of your family out and mostly across the border to Kenya as you can. Once in Kenya at the world's largest refugee camp, Dadaab, life is still really hard. It's about danger and rations and getting water and having shelter and trying to keep your family together and find a way out. And so that was the root for many, many of these families that are in this book that these soccer players are part of. And their relocation to the United States is part of a very deeply vetted, complicated process that gets them here, where they then have to make some decisions about where they want to live and how they want to live. And I think, you know, one of the major revelations of this story, I think one of the things that takes lots of people by surprise is that Lewiston is not where most of them were relocated to. They chose Lewiston. That there was a matter of factors that worked for them in terms of being able to find affordable housing and good schools, and that's what they wanted. And education and safety and keeping family together are really those priorities.
Mm. So in other words, it's not that some person in an office someplace made a relatively arbitrary decision that let's locate these thousands of Somali refugees, for instance, in Lewiston, Maine. That in many cases, they have at least some voice in where they ultimately end up. And so at least to some extent, we're talking about people making a choice to live in Lewiston, Maine.
Yeah, we are. And you know, it started with a handful of families back in 2001, February of 2001, that had been relocated to Portland, Maine, which is just southeast of Lewiston. But as Portland was becoming a very sought-after hot city in New England, it was losing vacancy. It didn't have space. So Portland relocated a handful, just a couple families, to Lewiston because Lewiston had space. And then it took off on its own. Those families talked and said, you know, to relatives who might have been relocated to the Atlanta region or Kentucky, come to Lewiston. So suddenly busloads began arriving. And City Hall was really taken aback. It was, you know, Portland didn't tell us you were coming. And, you know, Portland didn't send them. This was a voluntary migration of a community trying to find a place to lay roots.
Hmm. Can you explain the mathematics of especially the onset because you tell us that, mathematically speaking, what happened in Lewiston in terms of the population versus the number of immigrants was unprecedented in modern U.S. history.
Yeah, really, and that's a thing to think about in terms of the time span. It's how fast it happens and to how small of a city. So it isn't that Lewiston has the largest immigrant population in the United States. We know that's not true. They don't even have the largest Somali population in the United States. But it was a city of about 36,000 people, and in about a decade's time, about 7,000 African immigrants landed there. So it's an incredibly rapid, massive per capita transformation.
You say early in the book, and I think I've mentioned it already, that Maine is perhaps the whitest state in America. That is, at least before all of this occurred, its population was overwhelmingly white. Am I remembering that correctly? And to what?
Yeah, it dukes it out with Vermont quite a bit.
And as far as you know, is that still the case, or is this influx of refugees from Africa has that changed that mix, or is that in a sense still pretty much the case?
Well, I mean, it's largely the case. I do think statistically that Vermont is now, and I don't know what it's actually based on. I do think that Vermont is now called the whitest state in America. But certainly historically, you know, Maine has not had a very diverse demographic.
You tell us that there have been all kinds of incidents, and particularly early on, some really ugly incidents in and around Lewiston as these African refugees found their way to the city. Can you describe, as far as you can tell, because I don't think you were on the scene at the time, but the way it has been described to you, are we talking about a city that was largely welcoming, but with a small, if vocal, kind of fringe of those who were quite openly hostile to these newcomers, or was it not that positive a picture? And would you say that the town was maybe more evenly divided along the line of whether to welcome or not welcome at all these refugees?
Yeah, well, I think it's a fragile détente, and I think that's true for a lot of communities in the United States. And I think we're seeing right now in this moment how easy it is for these things to rise to the surface and become overt. Yes, Lewiston has had some painful moments, and I think that one of the things to look at in terms of those painful moments is what kind of a coming together of the community follows. And we see that in Lewiston. So, you know, in the early days when the then mayor wrote an open letter to the Somali community saying, we're supporting you, but you no more. You know, we're done. We're tapped. You have to tell everybody to stop coming. You know, that could have been a really ugly us versus them moment. And, you know, who belongs and who doesn't belong. But the Somali elders, you know, issued a letter in response, and then a rally of thousands of people came together called the Many in One Movement to reassert who Lewiston was and how welcoming it was going to be. So I think that, you know, you have these turning points, and sometimes community turning points can be tragic. You know, we saw that last year in Charlottesville, Virginia, when you had this sort of tragic moment of hatred that involved, you know, death and then a coming together. And Lewiston didn't have that sort of violent moment. And it was able to create the coming togethers and use these painful points as things to learn from and find yet another path forward. I mean, it's not perfect. It's really messy. And that continues today. But I think there's a strong desire to continue the path forward.
Hmm. Can you just say a brief word? We need not dwell on it, but I think it's important because it in a sense, kind of crystallizes the difficulty. Maybe you could mention, I believe, an incident that occurred in Lewiston that involved a mosque, or certainly a place where some of Muslim refugees would worship, and an ugly incident in which something was, in a sense, thrown into the midst of these Somali refugees. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about that, and what sort of the city's response to that was?
Yes, one of the most painful moments in the early days of the changing community was when a young man threw a frozen pig's head into the local mosque, the downtown mosque, while about 30 people or so were praying, and it was considered, you know, a hate crime. It was a reckoning point. It was, you know, it was, again, one of those flashpoints, really painful flashpoints. But it was for the most part, really calmly dealt with, acknowledged on all sides as an isolated incident. We did see, you know, there is a rash of, you know, there's always sort of that flurry of tiny things that can emerge in the wake of such a moment. But it was dealt with, and it's part of the history of this story. And then again, trying to figure out what the path forward is to move on.
I remember that because of something that just occurred in the city where I live, Racine, Wisconsin, although nothing quite as ugly as this. But on Facebook, a very brief but very hate-filled review of a local Pakistani restaurant was posted, and it was basically someone saying, "I don't ever want to go here. You know, I'm not going to support Muslim invaders. Eat American or something." And the response to that was that this place was deluged with customers the very next day. I mean, they were lined outside the door. People who made a point of coming to this particular business and patronizing it, and the lovely people who own it. And it was one of those cases of something really ugly touching off something really beautiful. And we can't even appreciate that beautiful part of the story if we aren't willing to look at the ugly.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that ugly isn't going to happen again. But
exactly.
Again, now you have a model, now you have a strategy to deal with it. I think, you know, Elizabeth Strout, one of the great American writers writing today, her book The Burgess Boys deals with this the pig's head incident in Lewiston. The novel is a fictionalized account of that, and you know she made incredibly reflective, nuanced art out of that moment. And it's, you know, the Burgess Boys is a great way of looking at how something ugly can be turned into something that you can learn from, and again, find that path forward.
We're speaking with Amy Bass about her book, One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. You tell us that a really important place for some of this, in a sense, assimilation to occur, I mean, for these refugees to become part of the community and for the community to begin to understand that they were a part of who they were, was at the schools, and particularly at the high school. I found it quite interesting, actually, the remarks you share with us from whoever was the principal of the high school at the time. Was that someone named Gus LeBlanc? Am I remembering your name?
Yes, Gus LeBlanc. Yeah.
And one of the his concerns at the time that the schools were beginning to have to deal with all of these newcomers was the sense of not making too many accommodations or accommodations that could not be sustained by the school, and yet doing what they needed to do in order to help these refugee students to be a successful part of the school and safe and able to thrive. Can you say just a word about the challenge that these schools faced and the way that they dealt with it?
Yeah, I think that the school is a place where these challenges, you know, really come to the forefront probably the most. And of course, the soccer team is part of the school because it's a high school team. So in the early days, you know, you needed to figure out the obvious things like translation, and having interpreters and aides and what have you, but also thinking about accommodating prayer during the day, for example, or what needs to change or be labeled differently in the cafeteria because there are some foods, you know, that are haram or forbidden for those who practice Islam. So it was a negotiation, and I think that that's one of the great things about this story is that we do often use that word that you just did, assimilation, to talk about immigration in the United States. But in so many ways, this was a negotiation. Prayer on Friday was one of the tipping points for Gus LeBlanc as principal, and he said, you know, so I invited the imam to come in and talk to me about this, and we figured out how best to deal with it and which days were the most important days, and yet how important school was, and that everyone needed to be in school on Fridays and couldn't be released early every week. So you see this back and forth. I think that you dramatically see it with the athletic director, Jason Fuller, who is very point blank about this and very just, this is what it is. He said, you know, these are our athletes and we're going to figure it out because they're our athletes. They're Blue Devils. So if it's Ramadan and they have to practice in the hot sun and they haven't had anything to eat or drink in 12, 13, 14 hours, it's going to be okay to sit out and sit under the tree in the shade for a few minutes and get your wits about you. And figuring those things out together and listening and learning from one another. So is it perfect? Absolutely not. But are there examples of how that sort of open negotiation made things work? Absolutely.
Hmm. At the high school level, I mean, and we're about to get to the soccer, which is, of course, the heart of your story. Were there other venues in which these African students also made their presence known in other sports, for instance, and in other matters too, like singing in the choir or playing in the band? Or are we really talking about soccer being very much the primary arena in more ways than one in which these particular students could become a really respected and even cherished part of the school?
Well, I think that soccer is certainly one of the marquee venues, and it's part of it is that that these kids have such a passion for the game. It's one of the central pastimes of the refugee camps to play soccer, and they really fill the parks. They play pickup games. They obsessively watch the English Premier League. So it's something that they will say, you know, it comes with the culture. They say that quite often about soccer. But no, of course, you see the presence spread. And, you know, one of my favorite days of research, I went into the high school library and I read every single Lewiston High School yearbook to just see what student bodies did and then what they start doing and then what they're doing now. And you see a transformation of names and faces and different kinds of activities. You have the recreational track league, track and field in Lewiston, has, you know, 11 and under, 10 and under girls relay teams breaking long-standing state records, running. And so you see kids absolutely in other sports. You see them leading in different ways. You see student government leaders. It's been several years since the first Somali student became president of the student body. So absolutely making their mark in lots of different ways, and not just in the high school, but in the community writ large. But soccer is an all-consuming thing, both within the Somali community and really sits next to hockey in Lewiston as the marquee sports now.
Right. You quote, I think, at one point, a city official saying something to the effect that we don't have enough soccer fields now. I mean, whatever
right.
public soccer fields there were within the borders of Lewiston were insufficient for all of these young African students who were desperate to be playing just on their own, let alone on their school's team. We have not yet spent much time, if at all, talking about one of the most extraordinary figures in your book, namely Mike McGraw, the soccer coach at Lewiston High School. His is certainly an interesting story, and one of the most interesting things about it is that even though he was a very fine athlete as a young man all the way through playing soccer at the collegiate level, that he had no aspirations whatsoever to be a coach at the time that he started teaching at Lewiston High School. Tell us more about how that ended up changing for Coach McGraw and anything else that you think is important for us to know about this man.
Yeah, Mike is Mike's an extraordinary figure. He's in his fourth decade of both teaching and coaching. And he does. He gets pulled into a very new soccer program back in the 1970s as assistant coach, and eventually takes the reins of the program. By the time this team finally gets to the top, it was a 33-year quest for him to find that state title. But he's really in many, many ways the perfect guy at the perfect time. He has a huge heart, and he has a huge head. He has a huge brain. And as he sees his roster starting to diversify and then just change, where it becomes a majority of his players are immigrant players, he really changes the way he does things. He reaches into the community. The first Somali coach is hired by the athletic department, Abdi Jabbar Hirsi, which is an enormously significant move, I think. And Abdi Jabbar is the son of Abdullahi Abdi, who is really just the father of all of these sort of soccer teams. One of my favorite things said about Abdullahi is that he's the coach of everyone. And Mike McGraw brings these guys in as really intricate parts of how to build this team and make this team have this historic undefeated championship season.
Tell us what the general chemistry tended to be between the white students of Lewiston High School on this soccer team and the particularly the Somali students, but others as well, who began to be more and more of an important part of the team. How was that initially greeted, and to what extent has that also been the same sort of fragile detente that you were mentioning in terms of Lewiston, Maine as a whole?
I think the team is very strong in its dynamic and in its respect, but it was absolutely something that they had to consciously work on. Thinking about what it means to play together and what it means to be a team, it is something that McGraw talks very consciously about, and the players do too. I think that one of the things that works here, I don't think it's an accident that we're talking about soccer. I think that the rules of soccer really speak to this kind of teamwork, because it's the way the game is supposed to be played. It's an unselfish game. It's a patient game. As many American sports folk like to criticize it for, it can be a low scoring game. It can be a slow moving game in terms of score and things like that. It's not a low scoring game when Lewiston's playing, I have to say. But I think he really put forward soccer first, and he said, the way we're going to do this is we got to get numbers on the board. We have to score, and to score, this is who we have to be, and this is how we have to act, and that worked, and I think it creates an example for others to follow.
Hmm. One of the stirring halftime speeches that you quote in your book was an incident, I believe, in which Coach McGraw was having to deal with the really unhappy reality of trash talk on the field. And maybe that's not even the right term, because I think trash talk is often somewhat good-natured, but certainly what we're talking about in this instance was much uglier and very much racist at its heart. And you quote Coach McGraw as saying, "We play the right way. You rise above everybody else. We play hard. We play fair. Because winning without playing fair is a shallow victory." Just how difficult a situation was this for these young refugee students? I mean, are we talking about the kind of things that, for instance, Jackie Robinson endured in his much-discussed first season in Major League Baseball?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about hate speech. It's a very particular kind of trash talk that Lewiston players encounter on the field, and obviously not just on the field. And I think the book details, some of the things that happen in classrooms and in the hallways and in the bathroom and walking down the street. But on the field, it's a particular moment, because as McGraw tries to instill in the team as a whole, there is one terrific way to retaliate, And the way you retaliate is beating them. So it's an interesting outlet, right, soccer in this context, because, yeah, there's going to be trash talk, but unlike if you're walking down the street or if you're in your classroom, what can you do on a soccer field? You can score, and then you can score and keep scoring.
And that's, of course, exactly what happened. Without getting too much into the specifics of what occurs in kind of the climactic season that is a very important part of your book, I think it's okay for us to get this specific and say that this incredibly successful Lewiston High School soccer team has an array of varsity starters in which only one of those players is white. By the time we get to that situation, that scenario, how accepted is that reality? I mean, how many people in the stands, in a sense, are colorblind because they are just so thrilled to see the Lewiston soccer team excelling to the extent that they are and are grateful for every player out on the field, no matter what their skin color? I mean, is that the predominant, maybe even nearly unanimous sense of fans in the stands? Or even is in that moment, are we talking about something more complicated?
I think it could be better. It's not that they're colorblind. It's not that they are tolerating, you know, difference within the community and the team. It's not even just that they're embracing it. It's that they're capitalizing on it. That this is a championship team, and it's a championship team that is brought, you know, overwhelmingly at the hands of kids who play soccer 24/7. I think that one of the most significant things to realize is that at, you know, the ultimate game, the end game, the state championship game in 2015, there's 4,500 people in the bleachers. And when you have 4,500 people in the bleachers, you don't just have the parents of the kids who are on the field in the bleachers. You have the community. Now, is it going to be, you know, roses all day? Not necessarily. I mean, a coming together doesn't necessarily mean a staying together. But for that one moment, for that game, Lewiston is there as one, cheering as one for the Blue Devils. And as they say over and over again, everybody bleeds blue. And that's the identity that they hold in common for moments like that.
Mm. By the way, I want to say that one of the things I so appreciate about your book is, in a sense, the long view that it takes of this kind of arc of development and growth for the community of Lewiston as a whole and the soccer program and in the school system and so on. And we really get a sense of what this journey was like in the early going. Would you mind saying just a word about a young man whom you talk about who was actually one of the first Somali refugees to play soccer in the school system, I mean, as officially a part of the team, and evidently a friendship that actually ended up being the basis for a young adult novel called Out of Nowhere. Can you just say a word about this young man and his particular story?
Sure. We're talking about Shobo Saban, who is living and working in Lewiston today. Shobo is not the very first. There had been a handful of players on McGraw's varsity roster, but Shobo is one of the real stars of the early days. At his tryout, he kind of floors the coaches with a rainbow flick, which is an unusual thing to see coming out of a rising ninth grader. And he, in middle school, became friends with a kid who helped him get on the team. Said to him, you know, I see you wearing soccer jerseys every day, Johnny McDonough, and this is, you know, we have a team. Do you love soccer? They really bonded over their love for soccer. They were in homeroom together. So Shobo starts playing, you know, in eighth grade, and then comes up into the varsity roster. And yeah, a lot has been made. So, you know, you mentioned the young adult novel about their story. And Shobo is there when Coach McGraw really tries to bring the team together more dramatically and emphasize the idea of together a bit more. Shobo goes off to Assumption College, graduates, and then has returned to Maine. He works for Maine Immigrant and Refugee Services, and is raising his family in Lewiston. So he's come full circle, and he's just a wonderful individual.
That's great. And one of the things that's kind of a touching moment as you recount what life was like for him as he first joined his middle school's soccer team. If I remember correctly, he was the only Somali on the team, at least at the time or when he first joined, and that there would be these, for instance, poignant moments in the cafeteria where he might sit down and eat with his soccer teammates, the only Somali at the table, and maybe across the room would be other Somalis at their own table. And one thinks about these young people, especially in kind of the early going, and in a sense, the tricky path that they were walking.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about, I think if you ask anybody, you know, what their most anxiety-ridden moments of middle school is, I think walking into the middle school cafeteria and figuring out where you're going to sit is huge. And even better is if you actually find the place to sit, if you have people who say, come sit here. That's really significant. And he found that moment, and he looked for that moment for a long time. Shobo's family first relocated to the outskirts of Atlanta, and he had a hard time there when he was finally invited to play with kids, and he was excited. It was to play football and not the kind of football that Shobo knew.
Mm-hmm.
So to find that seat at the table for him, he still talks about it. It meant the world.
Mm-hmm. You've touched on something I wanted to make sure we touched on. This will be the last question. At one point in the book, in talking about the kind of part of the community that these refugees have become, you write, it's not a hoop dream story where kids use sports to escape something. These kids aren't trying to escape. That part already happened. And they aren't problems to be solved. They are classmates, teammates, and neighbors forging relationships for a community to emulate. Soccer is how these kids live where they landed. I really love the way you put that, and I love that this is true, at least in Lewiston, Maine, to a large extent.
Yeah, and I think that's an important thing to understand, that sports is often portrayed in American life as a way out or a way up, and in Lewiston, it's a way to be. And I think that, you know, that's a critical part of acceptance and community and living in the same space together is to understand how that works.
Hmm. You write at one point, the team success embodies a negotiation between an immigrant community and its chosen home, an often difficult conversation about language, religion, culture, education, and family. And we do want to reiterate that beyond all of these really quite substantial, weighty issues that we have been discussing and that are so timely, that this is also an incredibly exciting book about soccer and about a fantastic team. You take time to introduce us to many of its star players who are such interesting young people with fascinating stories, each one, and about the dynamics of this team and Coach McGraw and his staff trying to make the most of these brilliantly talented young athletes. It's an amazing story, again, told in the book, One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together, published by Hachette and the author, Amy Bass. Amy Bass, congratulations. I love this book. I found the story just fantastic on so many levels and an important story for all of us to explore and reflect upon. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your great book. Best wishes.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow, I should say Monday, on The Morning Show, rescheduled from last Monday, Dan Gaitan, who's been a reporter at the Kenosha News over the last several years, and he's been doing extensive research into the topic of fraud within the hospice care industry. And in a matter of fact, he will be featured on the next episode of the CNBC television series American Greed, talking about some of what he has uncovered in this work. Next Tuesday, James Schatzman is going to join me, artistic director of the Choral Arts Society, to talk about their upcoming performance of Karl Orff's Kamrina Barana. Also, we'll talk to the author of a book called Your Creative Career. Next Wednesday, Guida Brown, who is Executive Director of the Hope Council, will be talking about fetal alcohol syndrome. March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Next Thursday, the author of a book called Saving Tarbu Creek, a radiant and inspiring story of one family's tireless patient efforts to rehabilitate one of the natural